So the reading is Matthew 17. On the church Bibles, it's page 984. And we'll be reading verses 1 to 13. So it's Matthew 17. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There, he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then, there appeared before them Moses and Elijah, talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." The disciples asked him, "Why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things. But I tell you, Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but have done to him everything they wished. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands." Then the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist.
So Josh is about to come to preach to us on that passage, but let me just pray for him now. Father God, as Josh comes to speak to us from this passage, I pray that you would prepare him to speak and prepare us to listen. Would he proclaim your message clearly and faithfully, and would you warm our hearts to hear it so that we might be moved by hearing your truth proclaimed.
Keep that passage open. We're going to be looking at it together. I want you to imagine that you're doing an extension or a large renovation on your house, and you've chosen your builder very carefully. Yeah, he seemed brilliantly qualified and reliable. He had good references. But then the guys come in and they start knocking things down and digging things up, and it's all dust and mess, and you're not sure if they're doing it exactly the way that you wanted them to. It's not what you expected. And at that point, you confront the builder to check. You have got the right plans. You do understand what we're aiming for. And he says, "Trust me. I know what I'm doing. And by the way, you need to pay me the next $5,000 to get the next stage of work done." I think at that point, you'd be forgiven for feeling a little bit uneasy. I've got to trust this guy. He's asking for more commitment now, more money. And that's a little bit of what the disciples are feeling like at the start of this passage. They've just recognized and declared that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. He's the one who's going to restore Israel, rescue Israel and restore the world. Brilliant. Jesus, we'll be your disciples. We'll trust you to get the job done and reward us. And then Jesus has said, "And I'm going to die and rise again." And the disciples have thought, well, that's not quite how we envisage this rescue going. But when they try and question Jesus, when they challenge Jesus on that, Jesus, "You can't die. That's not how the Messiah is going to rescue us. Jesus responds by going, okay, you guys have to be all in with me. Take up your cross and follow me. They thought they'd chosen the winner, the one God had promised had sent. The path he's taking and calling them on is making them uneasy. It's all very well saying it'll be worth it in the end, but if Jesus is saying you have to lose your life to follow him, how sure are you that he's the Messiah? And then at the very end of that passage, just before we get to today's passage, Jesus adds a reassurance. It's not just pie in the sky when you die. You don't have to wait till you die to see proof that Jesus, the Son of Man, is indeed God's King. Because in chapter 16 and verse 28, he says, truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Some of these disciples are going to get proof that Jesus is the Messiah, the King whose kingdom will one day rule everything. And then, 6 days later, Jesus takes three of his disciples with him. And the first glimpse of the Son of Man in his glory is given. What happens in these few verses is a journey from the ordinary into the extraordinary, the most awesome spiritual experience. Jesus and his three friends, they start with all the other disciples, you know, it's all become normal and every day, this group of people traveling together, catering, tidying up, teaching. And Jesus takes three of the disciples away. Verse 1, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. You know, a day of walking and clambering, fresh air, time to talk, time to think, time to pray. It's nice. It's not yet extraordinary. But then something happens. Peter, James, and John are not expecting this. Verse 2, there he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. For disciples who are struggling to understand how Jesus can be the Messiah if he's certain he will die, here is the confirmation they need that Jesus is the King. And what a confirmation. It's as if the curtain is pulled back and for a moment they glimpse the glory of the divine Son, which he's always had, but hidden it behind humble humanity. He's transfigured before them. His appearance has changed, and the change is described in terms of pure white light, powerful glory shining out. His face is like the sun, and we have actually seen the sun over the last couple of days, after a few weeks not seeing it. The sun is too bright to look at. His face is that glorious. And there were Old Testament echoes they may have picked up. You know, Moses' face was radiant after he'd spoken with God on the mountain. And in fact, it's so bright that he has to cover his face with a veil. And here is Jesus, face shining so brightly you can't look at him. Divine glory shining out. Or the description of the clothing also has an Old Testament echo. White as the light. Well, in Daniel 7, verse 9, we read of the Father, the Ancient of Days, described this way. His clothing was as white as snow. And in that passage, the Son of Man comes and is given glory and authority by the Ancient of Days. And so Jesus is not just having a spiritual experience. He is revealing his divine identity as the Son of Man to whom all authority is given, the one who one day all nations will worship. And the disciples get to see it. This is an awesome spiritual experience to confirm Jesus' identity. In terms of imagining the scene, I think it tells you much better than what you see in Tolkien, where Gandalf the Grey, suddenly reveals himself to be Gandalf the White, and that light shines out. The Grey Pilgrim, but actually, in Gandalf's case, he's an angel. In Jesus' case, an ordinary man who is actually God become man. And that by itself is spectacular. There's more to come, verse 3. Just then there appear before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Two great figures of the Old Testament are there. Now, one of my questions, you know, I want to ask is, well, how do they know who they are? They've never seen them before. There's not really any evidence of artwork that survived that long. They didn't have cameras that would have preserved photos. But they see Moses and Elijah. Moses is there talking to Jesus, the great lawgiver who went up on Mount Sinai to talk to God as a man speaks to his friend, is talking to Jesus on a mountain. The great miracle prophet Elijah, who went and spoke to God on the mountain after calling down fire from heaven to prove Yahweh is the true God, Elijah is there talking with Jesus. Men who had parted seas and stopped it raining for years are there on the mountain with Jesus, which confirms his importance, doesn't it? This is the sort of company he keeps. Luke tells us they're having a conversation with Jesus about his coming departure, his exodus. And again, thinking about what Moses did, this sets us up for the idea of a rescue. But whatever is going on in terms of Moses and Elijah, this is clearly a great spiritual experience. I take it most people have some sort of spiritual experience. It may be that it's a very everyday sort of thing of I believe in Jesus and I follow him. It may be that you've had experiences in life which you can't quite explain, moments of awe, moments of peace, moments of there's a presence here with me, a sudden insight into who God is and what he's done for us, or a sudden moment where you see creation or people and realize that they're glorious handiworks of God. Maybe it was an answered prayer that went beyond the mundane, or a miracle. I take it we've all had some little measure of spiritual experience. I'm also pretty confident that our spiritual experiences are pretty faint and shadowy compared to this experience. Three men walking the dusty earth, and suddenly heaven breaks through and they see these things with their own eyes. Years later, the Apostle Peter describes it like this in his second letter. For we did not follow cleverly devised stories when we told you about the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ in power, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory saying, "This is my Son whom I love, with him I am well pleased." We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain. This isn't private spiritual experiences or hallucinations. This is a public event. We were eyewitnesses, says Peter. Three men saw this happening in our world. And John writes in a similar vein in 1 John 1, 1-5. The glory of heaven shines out. Jesus' deity is revealed in blinding light. His connection to the greatest men of the Old Testament is made clear. What a confirmation to the disciples that they'd made the right choice in following Jesus. Jesus has been doing amazing stuff, but this is heaven coming down to earth. The ancient heroes of the faith are back. The glory of heaven shines out with a weightiness that makes it clear that it's the mountains and the darkness that are insubstantial, not the light or the spiritual realm. Jesus is revealed as being of such great power, which makes his walking in ordinary humanity most of the time even more extraordinary. And so Peter says what they're all thinking. Let's stay here. Verse 4, Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." This experience is so amazing, so mind-blowingly good. I want to stay here. I've got nothing else in my diary that would take precedence over this. Perhaps you've played the dinner party game, the idea of, who would I invite for the best dinner party? And here Peter thinks, these are the dinner party guests I'd love to listen to. I'd love to spend some time with Moses, with Elijah, with Jesus. This will be great. I'll happily spend the next month here, Jesus. Pure heavenly light, jaw-dropping beauty, the presence of our heroes from of old. Let me soak this up. This awesome spiritual experience has confirmed the disciples their right to follow Jesus as the Messiah. But Peter's desire to stay here and his plan for three shelters shows he's not fully understood the point of the experience. So he's got, this is amazing, I want to stay here, but he hasn't got what's going on. God the Father is going to clarify what's going on, because the most awesome spiritual experience points to the supremacy of Jesus. Peter talks about building shelters for Jesus and Moses and Elijah, and then they are enveloped in the cloud, verse 5. While he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I'm well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. Peter was excited about the spiritual experience, the mountaintop wonder. He wanted to stay there. And the problem was that he missed that it was pointing to how wonderful it was to have Jesus with him in normal life. Peter was meant to go. Jesus, the guy I'm following, is not just a great religious teacher. He's the glorious Son of Man. He's God. Look, Moses, the giver of the law, and Elijah, the great prophet, are pointing to him as the fulfillment of their ministry. I am so blessed to be following Jesus as he goes about his mission. That's what he's meant to be thinking. But what instead is going on in his mind is, this is a special place. It makes Jesus glow. And look, Jesus is talking to Moses and Elijah. I want them to stay. I'll build them shelters. And then perhaps I'll get a selfie with Moses and Elijah. I mean, they didn't have selfies back then, but you get the idea. Peter sees Jesus with Moses and Elijah and thinks that makes Jesus more awesome. Three shelters, you guys are equal. Jesus, I can see you've been promoted into the Premier League of Bible characters. It's a bit like on a film poster where you have the sort of the size of the names of the actors. Jesus, if I put you there and I have Moses and Elijah's name in the same size alongside you, that will really be a draw for the crowds. And so God the Father interrupts this mistaken thinking. This is too glorious for you guys to understand, so I'm hiding it. Now let me explain what's going on here. This is my son whom I love. With him I'm well pleased. Implication, not so much you guys, I don't know. Listen to him. God speaks. His voice terrifies the disciples and they fall to the ground. I think they're getting told off by God the Father. Just imagine your scariest teacher telling you off, and then multiply that by a million. God the Father shouts out of heaven at the disciples, "It's all about Jesus, you numpties. Focus on him, listen to him." And then Jesus lifts them up, tells them not to be afraid, and all they can see is Jesus. The whole event is meant to make it clear to the disciples the supremacy of Jesus. He's the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. He's God become human. He's the king whose exodus will rescue humanity. And a poster with Jesus' name alone is a sufficient advert for God's kingdom. Because he's the one the law, represented here by Moses, and the prophets, represented here by Elijah, pointed towards. Neither the law nor the prophets could finish the job by themselves. Moses and Elijah left their jobs unfinished. And each of them was followed by a man called the Lord Saves. God Saves. So they couldn't finish the job. Somebody called Joshua or Elijah followed them at handover at the Jordan. And here now is the one who's going to finish the job. The Lord Saves. Moses and Elijah couldn't meet God face to face. In Exodus 33 and 34, Moses asked for that, and God says, "You can't see my face and live." You get to see the back part of me, but you can't see my face. Elijah covers his face when he meets God on the mountain, but here they are, talking face to face with Jesus. Not there to take the limelight, but there to be the spotlight, pointing to Jesus. And when Peter gets caught up with these Old Testament figures being there, God the Father steps in and says, "No. This is my son. Jesus is the one I love and am pleased with. Pay attention to him." In Matthew's gospel, the confession that Jesus is the Christ and the transfiguration, it's kind of like the middle point. Is there any... Have the slides disappeared? I'm not sure if the slides are uploaded. They're not there. Okay, that's fine. There's a diagram which has sort of three points in the Gospels at this point. So it's the middle point. The confession that Jesus is the Christ and that he's thinking about the cross, followed by the transfiguration, it's the middle point. Right at the start, there is the baptism of Jesus and the temptation of Jesus. So the voice from heaven comes at the baptism, confirms that Jesus is the Messiah, sends him out in the power of the Spirit to be face temptation. That sets the scene. In the middle, you have Jesus' identity and his mission, and the transfiguration confirms that for the disciples. And then at the end of the gospel, you have his actual death on the cross and the resurrection. And the baptism, the transfiguration, and the resurrection are like the three high points, the three points when heaven breaks in. And this time in particular, you get the listen to Jesus. That's the key thing that's being added here. He's right when he says his mission is to die. But the challenge for us as we've worked our way through Matthew's gospel is that we can be like the disciples. We can be like them in focusing on the things, the signs that should point us to the supremacy of Jesus. And we're like the one people gazing at the sign going, "That sign's amazing." Earlier in Matthew, we we've seen that one of the issues is if with the Pharisees, it's human traditions that blind them to Scripture and to Jesus. And here it seems to me that we're getting a hint of a danger which will appear at other points in the New Testament letters, that spiritual experiences can end up being things that stop us from seeing Jesus. It's not that spiritual experiences are inherently wrong, just as there's nothing inherently wrong with having traditions and teachings, things that help us understand the Bible and live it out. But the danger is that we can so focus on the experiences we've had or the experiences we want that we don't notice that they're meant to point us to Jesus. We spend more time thinking, I want a mountaintop experience, rather than saying, isn't it great Jesus is with me in the valley? The spiritual experience looms larger than Jesus. That may raise some questions for you. What I'd like to do is take a minute or two to think. Firstly, there's a question. Yep, that's the diagram. Next slide, please. There's a question which is, where have you seen people's focus slip onto the spiritual experience rather than Jesus? But there may also be other questions that what we've looked at so far has raised that you want to ask. So take a minute to think about this question. Where have I seen examples where people's focus has been to come on spiritual experiences that's led them away from seeing Jesus as supreme? And then also, if there are any other questions from what I've said so far, you've got a minute or two to chat and then we'll share together. Let's share some of those things. So some of you may never have come across this, that's okay. But I think some of us will have had experiences in our past that help us to see the relevance of this issue of spiritual experiences eclipsing Jesus or becoming separated from the supremacy of Jesus. So anyone want to share some things they've seen where that's happened? Yes, thank you. And Charlie's running around with the mic, so put your hand up if you want to share something. Be brave.
So at youth events and some old events, when there's a call from the front for ministry at the end and you go up, whatever the call was, just because you want to be prayed for and you want to be up at the front where everything's happening, apparently.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So the danger of thinking there's a special place up front, I need to go there regardless of what the message was. Yep.
I think having heard about people experiencing dramatic sort of supernatural things, but not having experienced that myself, I'm often tempted to sort of think, oh, if only I could see that or experience that, then suddenly following Jesus would be really easy.
Yeah. So, yeah. Any other examples?
Online, there can be quite a focus on people who've had maybe like near-death experiences or as being sort of the evidence that of like what happens after we die, as opposed to seeing that Jesus is the one that's gone through death and has told us what happens.
Yeah, really helpful. So that's not to deny that there might be near-death experiences, but the sort of the focus can become all about let's chase up the next person who's had an experience like that, rather than let's look what's happened to Jesus. Yeah. Any other examples? Kate's got one.
Certain churches or maybe worship events where you have like really fancy worship, lots of bells and whistles, effects, you know, that you can focus on the feeling you get versus that message or what's should be being sung.
Yeah. And of course, there's nothing wrong with feelings or with good events, but there can become a point when the way I judge whether I'm meeting with God is, do I feel certain things in a meeting rather than have I heard his truth and spoken to him?
I guess a little bit similar to that, but sometimes huge, like beautiful cathedrals and have so many beautiful paintings and things like that, and you know, so old, so much tradition, you end up focusing on that rather than on the beauty of Jesus.
Yeah, so the sort of the person who says, well, I can only really worship in a beautiful building with a wonderful choir, only that aesthetic enables me to worship God or something, and you think, well, actually, it's about Jesus, so we can worship in a hut with none of that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, those cover the sort of things that I was thinking about. I think there's both a sort of charismatic worship experience side of stuff, which is there's lots that's good in that, but the danger is that we focus on an experience that we get or a particular place, and we think that's it. And if I don't get that, I'm not meeting with God. And then the other side can perhaps be a sort of more traditional or ornate ritual that I need to have in order to have God. And it can end up taking us away from Christ. Once again, I need to emphasize that the problem isn't spiritual experiences. I mean, Jesus led his disciples up the mountain to have this spiritual experience. When we use them rightly, when they're from God, it confirms us in our understanding of who Jesus is. It helps us to trust Jesus as he teaches us about his sacrificial mission. So nothing wrong with spiritual experiences if God gives them. Nothing wrong with enjoying worship. But I guess, you imagine them going down the mountain. The other nine disciples all think, well, I wish I'd been the one Jesus had chosen to go up the mountain. That sounds like an awesome spiritual experience that I didn't get. They would have wanted it. But there's something really helpful about knowing that not all the apostles got this. Not every Christian gets every particular spiritual experience. God gives different gifts as he chooses. He leads his children on slightly different paths. And so therefore, we shouldn't be surprised that we don't all get the same experiences. We shouldn't demand that I see the miracle someone else has seen or have the experience someone else has had in order to be a real Christian. No, we can't demand it. We can't manufacture it. We should prayerfully seek to know God better, to walk with Jesus daily. The disciples are just walking with Jesus daily as they go up the mountain. They don't know what's going to come. We want to focus on Jesus as supreme. And then if we're given spiritual experiences, we weigh it up against this criteria. Is it helping me to see that Jesus is the Son of God who the Father loves and that I should listen to him? If it takes me away from rejoicing in how great Jesus is and how necessary his cross is, then it's likely either a counterfeit experience, so it could be a human manufactured thing, it could be an evil spirit manufactured thing, or it could be a spiritual experience from God that I'm misusing, like the disciples are slightly missing the point here. Peter, James, and John were given the most awesome spiritual experience, and the whole point of it was to make them thrilled to be walking around the ordinary villages of Galilee with Jesus. We have the beloved Son of the Father with us. We have the man who pleases God with us. We have the one who fulfills all the laws and the prophets as our friend. We have God instructing us. Let's keep following Jesus up mountains and down into valleys. Let's keep looking up and seeing no one except Jesus supreme. Let's keep listening to Jesus. And that leads us to our final point. Jesus is confirmed as supremely great in this mountaintop experience so that the disciples will believe that he is carrying out God's plan by dying for them. This experience confirms his mission to suffer. Once again, as when Peter confessed Jesus as Messiah, Jesus doesn't want people to hear about the mountaintop transfiguration until they also know about his death and resurrection. Verse 9. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." So, the transfiguration by itself, knowing that Jesus is glorious by itself, it doesn't work. It needs to be also be connected with the truth that he's the one who dies to rescue people and rises again. And this instruction by Jesus leads, and I'm not quite sure of how the link is made in the disciples' minds, to a question about Elijah. Verse 10, the disciples asked him, "Why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Now, they have just seen Elijah on the mountain with Jesus. And perhaps they remember there's a prophecy in Malachi, chapter 4 and verse 5, that says, "See, I will send the prophet Elijah to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes." Elijah was an Old Testament prophet who had particularly stood up against corrupt kings and called people back to God. He's supposed to pave the way for the day of the Lord. Elijah comes first. They've just seen Elijah on the mountain. Perhaps they're thinking that's the fulfillment of the prophecy. The day of the Lord is about to come. But Jesus says, no. Verse 11, Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things. But I tell you, Elijah has already come. And they did not recognize him, but have done to him everything they wished. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands." Then the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist. So Jesus says, this prophecy from Malachi, it's not about this transfiguration. That's a private event, really. The prophecy is about John the Baptist, the Elijah figure, the prophet in the wilderness wearing hair garments and rebuking kings and calling people to prepare for God coming. He's already come. John the Baptist came to prepare the way for Jesus, and he's been killed. They've done to him everything they wished. And that's another sign that the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Sometimes we want a glorious Jesus who will stay on the mountaintop. And let us stay there too. A glorious Jesus who never sullies himself with the mess of this world or calls us to take up our cross and follow him. A Jesus with whom relationships are easy and we simply follow our desires and it's what's right. At times it's attractive to have a sanitized Jesus, all soft white light and pristine clothes and the best company and scenery. But the glory of the Transfiguration is both greater than that and given to confirm a far harder path than that. The glory is greater. It's not soft glow and gentle voices. The disciples couldn't look at Jesus' face without being blinded. It was like the sun. When they tried to stay there and put too much attention on Moses and Elijah, God the Father sweeps in and rebukes them, and the result is that these tough fishermen are lying on the ground, terrified. Jesus in his majesty, heaven unveiled, is greater than our soft imaginings of spirituality. Until we're made perfect when Jesus comes again, his unveiled glory would overwhelm us and shatter us, weak and sinful humans. We say we want to know God better, and we do. But there's a sense in which we also hold back from wanting to know God better because it would be too shattering, he is too glorious, it would expose us too much and transform us too much. The glory of the Transfiguration is greater than our soft view of spiritual experience. And the whole experience confirms that the words Jesus has spoken at the end of Matthew 16 about the centrality of the cross for Jesus' rescue mission and the need for disciples to deny themselves and take up their cross, all of that is true. God the Father commands us to listen to his beloved Son. We want spiritual experiences as personal proof, encouragement, a nice addition to the Christian life. The pattern of the New Testament suggests that those who have extraordinary spiritual experiences are those who God has chosen to face extraordinary trials as witnesses of the crucified and risen Christ. James ends up being beheaded for being a follower of Jesus. Peter is crucified upside down. John is exiled. All of them live hard lives as they witness to Jesus. The reason it's revealed to us how great Jesus is so that we will be willing to proclaim the crucified Christ and suffer like him in this world. We're being called to live lives in the ordinary, everyday life with Jesus and being like Jesus, which means everyday relationships of bearing with one another, of giving way to others, of kindness when we don't feel like it, of speaking the truth when it's going to be awkward. That's what taking up our cross and following Jesus means. The spiritual experiences are given so that we'll listen to Jesus and follow in that way. We're not being asked to take up our cross and follow Jesus by a dodgy builder who gives us no proof. Someone who's asking for another $5,000 as they keep going with the project, but you're not for sure it's going to be finished. But we're being asked to trust Jesus in his restoring all things. And his proof isn't actually the Transfiguration. I mean, three witnesses is good. It's solid. It's enough to prove something happened. But what gives us confidence that Jesus is this glorious Son of Man is the resurrection, witnessed at one point by 500 people. The resurrection of Jesus where his brothers who thought he'd gone out of his mind and one of his enemies who was trying to persecute his people become convinced that he is alive and are willing to die, saying, "We have seen the risen Jesus." We have the proof that Jesus is the Son of Man, whether we have spiritual experiences or not. And when the cross seems like a foolish rescue plan and the path of the cross following Jesus seems too costly, we look to these proofs of Jesus' identity and supremacy and follow Jesus in the everyday. This is God's will for you. A voice from the cloud said, "This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." Let's have a moment to reflect on on Jesus and what he's been saying to us. I'll pray and then I'll hand over to Tim. Lord Jesus, we thank you that you are glorious, that you are both truly human, one who walked this earth in all its suffering, but also Son of God, loved by the Father, radiant in majesty and holiness. We thank you that you are our God, and we thank you that as you give proof of that divine glory, you do so that we will have confidence of you walking with us in our everyday lives. Please help us to rejoice now and daily in how wonderful it is that you walk with us through this world. You are our King who comes down to our level. You are our King who by your Spirit lives with us and never leaves us. Help us to see your greatness and rejoice in your closeness. Amen.